sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. The number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. We'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes here. Start out the plant of the week, golden privet. Good morning, Ton.
Good morning.
So tell us about golden privet.
Well, golden privet is a shrub that's been around for quite a while, and as the name implies, it has a bright yellow leaf when the new growth comes out that fades to kind of a chartreuse or a really nice shade of green.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about this one. It's just because the privet plants have been around for a long, long time. There's a whole group of them. We've talked about low-dense privet, which only gets 3 or 4 feet tall. And there's, you know, Cheyenne privet, Chinese privet, Amur River privet. There's all these different species. But the golden privet is one that I think is showier. And it also is, the flowers are sterile, so it's not going to spread. And a lot of the United States, many of the privet species have been banned because they've become invasive in our forests and along our waterways. I've even seen in Utah County, going upper canyons, privet sprouting up along the riverways and things. And so it's not as bad here, but anywhere there's moisture available, there's that potential. But this particular privet is a tough, durable shrub, and it doesn't have that potential to become invasive.
Okay, so how big does it get?
It depends on the type. Most often, you're just going to find what's called golden privet, or sometimes it's called golden vickery privet.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to get 10 to 12 feet tall without pruning. You can keep them down to 6 if you do use some renewal pruning and a little bit of shearing, but they will get taller. There is a proven winner's variety called golden ticket that grows only between 4 and 6 feet. And so if you need a smaller hedge, many retailers carry the Proven Winners lines. And so the golden ticket privet might be one that you could use.
Why do they say put it in an informal hedge?
Because it gets big. It will hedge formally, but it needs to be left bigger. You know, if you need a small 2 to 3 or 4 foot tall hedge, this will do that for 3, 4, 5 years, but it wants to be 10 feet tall, so you would need to let it grow, or eventually you just train it and prune it into stubs. And so it will do well informally. If you want, you can mix it with like Rose of Sharon and lilac and things and just mix it up along, say, a fence line, and you'll have something giving you color most of the season if you do that. But it also, if you don't trim it down into nothing, tolerates formal pruning, and it makes actually quite a beautiful formal hedge.
Okay. So full sun.
Yes.
So it'll tolerate the west side of your house.
Absolutely.
And will it still look good? Like,
yes.
Some things tolerate, but they don't look great.
Privet, especially this golden privet, will grow almost anywhere. In fact, the shade is actually the least favorable place to grow it, because the yellow foliage quickly fades to green, and because it needs sunlight. And so in shade, a lot of times our plants that are either red or yellow colored will fade to green to maximize the amount of chloroplast and photosynthesis to get more sunlight. But hot south exposure, it's actually a plant that is used quite a bit in apartment complexes, industrial parks, because it's so durable. Once it's planted and established, about the only thing that will go after it are strawberry, or just root weevils, like strawberry root weevil. They notch the leaves. And so you may need to monitor and spray for that. But otherwise, there just isn't much that gets it.
What does it need as far as water and soil?
Average amount of water. So once established, after 2 to 3 years, watered weekly to a depth of about a foot. And any soil, almost, as long as it's not too salty. It grows in clay, it grows in sand, and does just fine. It is one that, you know, in Eagle Mountain and areas, it should do okay. You know, again, if your soil's the measure of the salinity is above 2.5 or 3, I'd be a little cautious. But this is just a very durable plant.
All right, one that you don't have to mess with a whole lot.
No, it's just one that it's pretty. It's durable, it's utilitarian, it's pest and disease resistant. And so if you need something that you don't want to pay a lot of attention to after it's established, these golden privet are really a candidate for that.
All right. The golden privet shrub. My words today, I want to combine bush and shrub. The golden privet shrub is the plant of the week, and you can find out more on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. I need to tell our listeners that we have a shortened show today. We have NCAA men's basketball, BYU versus Texas. Our pregame begins at 11, so if you have a burning question, you need to get your call in as soon as possible. Number to call, phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Good morning. Thanks for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Number to call with your questions. Phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Let's go to our text line. We have a number of questions coming in. The first one, this person says they have grass under their huge elm tree, but it's not growing well. Could it be too much shade? It's on the south side of their home.
It absolutely could be too much shade. When you have excessive shade, the grass and most other things don't do well. There are a few weeds that will grow in that sort of shade, but it's something that they may need to limb the tree up. Or if they want grass under there, they could try planting red fescue under it. It's a turf grass. It looks different, not incredibly so, but it has a slightly different texture than Kentucky bluegrass. But they could top dress or go aerate under there and then put down red fescue seed this spring and see if it will establish. If the red fescue doesn't, what will often happen is it will grow for a couple of years and fade out. Mm-hmm. And if you cannot grow red fescue under there, there is no turf grass that will. Oh. And so you either need to open up the shade a little bit to let some sunlight in, or you need to put bark mulch under the tree and just go that direction.
Call it good.
Yeah.
All right. Next listener wants to know, with these unseasonable temperatures,
unseasonable,
my brain isn't working properly, and that along with autocorrect, with these unseasonable temperatures, is this going to affect the pruning of their fruit trees?
No, they need to prune at the recommended times, the pears and apples in mid-February and the stone fruits in mid-March. What I'm worried about is that in fruit trees, they accumulate what are called degree days, and every fruit tree that we grow here has a certain number of hours of coldness that it needs to be exposed to before it can break dormancy. Mm-hmm. And some of our hardiest trees, you know, will require anywhere from 600 to 1,000 hours at around 40 degrees. And the 40 degree temperature is the max wherein those trees are accumulating the maximum number of degree days. At 30 degrees, they're still accumulating some, but it's fewer. And so we've been at 40 for so long that the trees will stay dormant, but that programmed dormancy from the required degree days is no longer there. And so if we warm up for a couple of weeks into the 60s, say sometime in mid to late March, they could bloom. And then we get cold again and they get frozen off. And so this temperatures we've been having at 40 to 45 degrees every day is really kind of scary for especially our apricots or European or Japanese plums, even our peaches, because we don't want them to bloom too early, because those two kinds of dormancy where you have the degree day model, and then if it's cold, they stay dormant, but as soon as it warms up, they'll pop. And so if we, the two dangers are we get warm and then cold again, or 3 or 4 years ago, we just stayed in the 50s through April and the trees tried to bloom, but it was too cold for honeybees. And we had a really light fruit year, a crop that year, because of those sustained cool temperatures through April into May. And so it's not that I want to get colder, but just 3 or 4 degrees daily would be something we could use for the fruit trees so that they can go through their life cycle normally and not have this strange kind of warm weather, you know, through February.
So it definitely could impact it could. Pruning.
It could. Well, pruning itself, no. It's just the blossoming that I'm more worried about. You prune when during those recommended times.
So you're still going to prune during the same times.
You are.
Okay.
But it's more the degree days we've been accumulating the last 2 or 3 weeks. Those trees are, as soon as we're warm, they're going to be ready to go. And there's not going, there's usually when we start, if we have an average year, there's usually about a week to 10 days that those trees will stay dormant before those blossoms open. But because they've accumulated all the required degree days, they're going to open a lot faster than they normally would if we get warm.
Yesterday was so nice. I actually spent an hour out in my yard.
Yeah.
And all the snow melted off. I mean, we live on the bench, and all the snow melted off the front yard, which faces west, of course. But
yeah, I've been outside in just a long sleeve shirt or maybe a sweatshirt. I haven't had to wear a coat in quite a while.
Yeah, there was some leaves that I didn't get to, so I was out raking a few leaves, getting some fresh air. It was great, but kind of concerning at the same time.
It is.
All right, next listener says they have an old Jonathan apple tree that's in a 2-year feast and famine cycle. What can they do to break the cycle?
Thin it. They need to, after it blossoms and the fruit's the size of about a pea to a dime, they leave one apple per cluster, because generally there will be a cluster of anywhere from 2 to 4, maybe 5 apples. Mm-hmm. And they're going to leave what's called the king bloom or the king fruit. And that's going to be the biggest one in the cluster, and they just need to go in and thin the rest off so that there's one apple for every 6 inches to foot of branch.
Marilyn in Garland says that she's tried several times to grow cabbage. Covered the plants and controlled butterflies and caterpillars, but have had major problems with aphids. Any suggestions on how to control aphids with cabbage?
The only thing besides the use of pesticides that I know to do is to get the cabbage in, and before you plant it, you may actually almost dunk the top of the plant, if you're doing transplants, into some soapy water, just to almost baptize it to kill any aphids or anything on there, and then rinse it off after you've done a thorough wash. Then plant it, but then they're going to need to get what's called floating row cover and tent those plants, and they're going to need almost a low tunnel, and that's they're going to have to make sure that there aren't any gaps in there so that the cabbage looper moth and different things can't get in there to feed, because sometimes, especially if you grew them there the previous year, or broccoli or something, you trap them in there. And so you need to plant them in a new spot and immediately tent them under floating row cover. There are some systemics out there that will work well, but I don't like putting systemics on my food. So
if she's trying to plant them in the same spot, that's the reason the aphids are coming back.
Well, it can be. And so she needs to rotate to a new area in case there's overwintering pests in that soil, and then use the low tunnel frames and put floating row cover over the top and seal it in really well with soil so that the little beasties can't crawl under it.
So when you say baptize that plant when you get it, does that mean that the aphids oftentimes come with the plant?
They can.
Okay.
They can,
so
not
always. So you're eliminating a lot of the possibilities.
You are. And so if you have transplants, what you would do is just make sure that you're securing them in the tray or the little pot, and then you just get yourself, say, a gallon of lukewarm soapy water, two or three drops of dish soap in there, and then just dunk it in to the soil. And then just kind of stir it around a little bit so that everything is submerged. Pull it out and then just gently rinse that start with lukewarm water and let it dry. Okay. And that way, any aphids, spider mites, anything along those lines are most likely going to be dead if you've used that soapy water.
We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Tom Bettis with you this morning, taking your calls. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can text us your questions at 57500. Our next texter, Tom, says they have a 20-foot wide section on their property. They want to get a columnar flowering or shade tree, and the height doesn't matter. Any suggestions?
There's a few they could use. There is a columnar oak that maxes at about 25 to 30 feet, but it's narrow. Mm-hmm. It's called Kindred Spirit, and it's a really neat little tree. My neighbors have some that have been in for 7 or 8 years, and they've reached 15 feet. And I think they do some minor trimming on them just to keep their shape up. But that's one that's going to be around in 50 or 100 years because the oaks are very long lived. If they want flowering, you're a little more limited. There are columnar flowering cherries. If they could find them, flowering sergeant cherry is one they could look at. There is a columnar Quanzon cherry, but the Quanzons are probably the most showy of the flowering columnar cherries, but they're also their duration isn't there. They're getting about 15 to 20 years and they're going to die. That's just what Quanzon cherries do, and you expect that when you plant them. And then there's also a columnar flowering plum that will give you 25 or 30 years. Now, all of these are going to eventually require a little bit of pruning, but I think they're fine. There's also some columnar crab apples, one called Merrill Lee that gets about 20 feet tall and 10, 12 feet wide. So I believe Cameron over at Progressives carries Merrill Lee, and it can be found at other garden centers too. But of that list, I would go with Kindred Spirit Oak or Merrill Lee Crab Apple.
Okay. Terry from Mountain West says that, not sure if it's he or she, collected bristlecone pine cones in Colorado, let them open over the winter. Now the seeds fell out. They want to know the best way to grow them in pots to eventually plant them in the yard.
Be patient, because you can plant them, and I would have to look at the stratification protocols, and they're going to be online, but if you do an internet search of stratifying the Pinus edulis, what's the common name again?
The bristlecone.
Not Pinus edulis, flexilis. If stratifying bristlecone pine seed, it'll bring up what they need to do.
Okay.
But there could be a couple of year process for some of these. But even when they sprout, it'll be 5 or 6 years before those trees are big enough to plant outside.
Patience.
And it'd
fun
be
experiment, though.
Yeah, up to 50 years, between 20 and 50 years before they ever produce pine cones, you know, to mature and things. And so they're just going to be slower growing. Now, the bristle cone is one that I think it would be fun to do. And what they would have to do is just leave them in the pots, and they might have to transplant them up, but they can be overwintered in a shed over the winter or planted in a protected spot. But it's just one that they're going to need to keep away from deer and protect, because it'll be years before it's big enough to really give them a lot of ornamental value.
Yeah, they were wondering, is there a best time of year to plant them? Like,
if you're just wanting to put them in the ground, you put them in the soil.
They want to start in pots.
This is not just something you plant and start. Unfortunately, they're not like a marigold, or they need to look up the propagation protocols, because these native plants, especially that are adapted to arid areas, they have all sorts of adaptations that limit germination, so that the conditions have to be right, because there has to be enough moisture in the soil for them to take. And so they have all these pre-programmed adaptations in the seeds, and it's just, you don't throw them in soil and just let them sprout.
Okay.
And so it makes it difficult to do, and that's why they really need to look up a propagation protocol.
Where would be the best place to
Google?
Do that? There's not like a, like there, USU doesn't have propagation of these. Oh no.
No. It's such a specific
okay.
niche thing, but there are areas out there, universities will have it, and areas that specialize in native plants, but it's something, and the information is out there, but they need to look it up, and this is going to be a commitment for them to do.
Okay, would they put EDU in their search?
They don't necessarily need to. It's such a specialized search.
They're going to only find very few.
Yeah, they're going to find very few. And there are a few native plants journals. There are a few universities that have websites that are dedicated to propagation. Oregon State University may have a few things in their horticulture program. So it's out there, but it's not that it's going to be very obscure, but it's just a very specialized thing.
Okay. Scott is on the line in Tooele. Good morning, Scott. What was your question?
Two quick questions. Mm-hmm. One, if you could control the ground temperature for your fruit trees and keep it cool longer in the spring, how would that affect the time they bloom?
It would delay blooming a bit. There were some professors in the 70s at USU that did these kinds of experiments. They actually wrapped refrigerator coils around tree trunks and kept the trunks cold longer, and they delayed blooming for 3 or 4 days, but the expense at doing it was huge. I mean, you could probably go to Eastern Washington or, you know, some of the fruit growing areas and pay about as much as you would for the electricity to do it and the equipment as it would be to just, you know, take your lumps and lose your fruit sometime.
Thank you. The other question, here in Tooele, the soil doesn't freeze very much because there's usually snow on the ground. But I have a pear tree and it gets something in it. I can't say that it's worms or larvae, but it ruins the pears. But most years it just destroys my pears. But
now when you say what's happening to the pears?
Something burrows into them and spoils them, and it goes right to the core where the seeds are, and the rottenness comes right from the core.
And are you spraying the trees for coddling moth?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I haven't sprayed at all.
I mean, it's when you grow fruit trees for fruit, but the best analogy I can give you is like buying a car and not changing the oil and then expecting the car to go 200,000 miles. You know, when you have fruit trees, they do need to be sprayed. You can do it organically, and there's organic sprays out there. But you're getting coddling moth most likely in those pears, and that's what is causing them to spoil.
Where do they come from?
Satan. No, no, they're just a natural pest. They were probably the apples we grow are native to Asia, and they were probably imported as we brought them from Europe to North America to grow them. Some of the pests we have here are native, but they're established here in Utah. In northern Utah, they have 3 generations per year, and they overwinter under your pear trees. And so some other things you can do: clean up the fruit that you don't use off the ground and throw it away or compost it, and then spray, especially those first 2 sprays. I would recommend subscribing to the USU Pest Lab updates. They're free, and they just come in email, and they'll tell you down to the day when you need to spray, and they'll give you both conventional and organic options. And so you could probably get away with spraying just 2 or 3 times through the season to keep most of that coddling moth out.
Thanks. I'll get a hold of
them. One other question for you real quick. When you harvest your pears, are you letting them ripen on the tree or are you picking them a bit early?
I have a hard time telling when they're ripe.
So what you're going to want to do is let the pears start to drop. And when you see you're going out there and kind of looking, and you see like 5 or 10 of them that have dropped off the tree. On the south and west side of the tree, go and grab one of the larger fruit that's been exposed to the sun and just kind of twist and pull. If that pear comes off easily and doesn't yank leaves off, they're ready to be picked. And so you'll pick those on the south and west first, and then the ones on the interior of the tree and the north and east sides about 5 to 7 days later. Do you have Bartlett pear or are they Anjou's? What kind of pears are they?
Anjou.
Okay, so they're Anjou. So what you're going to do is bring them in the house and then refrigerate them for between about 3 and 6 weeks. They need to go in the refrigerator. But then you can start taking them out of the refrigerator and finish ripening on your counter. And it'll take anywhere from 3 to 7 days to ripen. But those Anjou pears, they're called a winter pear. And you can look up online care of winter pears. But they're meant to be able to be refrigerated most of the winter, and you just pull them out as you need them and let them sit for 3 or 4 days, and they're absolutely delicious.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you're
all
welcome.
Right, Scott, thanks so much for your call this morning. We need to take a break. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Thanks for joining us this morning for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Terry would like to know. Terry has grapevines on a pergola in their backyard, and every fall they've been getting thousands of white gnats in their grapes, and they want to know, what are they and how can they get rid of them this year?
It's Western Grape Leaf Hopper. Ooh. And USU has fact sheets out on it. But they're going to, if they're building into the thousands, and they can defoliate the grapes and over time cause quite a bit of damage, you know, reduce productivity and eventually kill them. So there's a few things they can do, but as in the summer, you know, as soon as we start to turn hot, they need to monitor those grapes a couple of times a week, go out and tap on the leaves a little bit and just investigate. And as soon as they start to see those leaf hoppers in there, they need to go to the garden center and get a spray, something with permethrin, or there's a number of them out there. And depending on the particular spray, they may need to spray weekly for 2 or 3 weeks to control them enough to get them through the season.
Next listener would like to know if they can put used coffee grounds, till them into the soil in Kaysville.
That is fine. It's you don't want to saturate the soil with them, but an inch of them tilled in 5 or 6 inches deep or worked into the soil that deep is just fine.
Next listener is moving to Fairview, elevation about 6,000 feet. They're wondering what fruit trees will grow and produce in that climate.
Well, I want to bring up really quick, I'm glad they specified the city, because 6,000 feet in Fairview is far different than 55 or 6,000 feet all along the Wasatch Front. Mm-hmm. And so they want to know which fruit trees.
What they could grow there that would be successful.
There's a lot of things, and there's not enough time to mention it all. We would need some more specifics. So that might be a phone call, but you know, they're probably a zone 5, warm zone 4, zone 5, as far as USDA cold hardiness goes, but there's all sorts of things they can grow.
Next listener says, can you tell them if they can spray a field? I'm going to need some time to figure out what that says. The last person wants to know where to sign up for the pest lab updates at USU.
I will find them on the break and then have Michelle post it to Facebook.
Okay, so we're going to give them that
information.
Okay, when we come back following the top of the hour news, we are going to be talking about blackberry management in Utah and selecting blackberries in Utah. So we hope you will stay with us through the top of the hour news for that special feature. And then we'll be taking more of your calls and questions. And our phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Check out the plant of the week, the golden privet.